It is Wednesday, November 10th. Tomorrow is Veterans Day. Have you acknowledged the veteran in your life?
Welcome to Let's Get To, the baseball show from the fan's perspective. Now here's your host, James Christopher.
And so today is Veterans Day, and on this show, I've been pretty open about my service, what it means to me. And I wanted to share with you guys a segment from our school web series called Saterview. One of our students, McKay, wanted to interview me about my veteran experience, and I thought it would fit perfectly into this episode.
What is Veterans Day?
So Veterans Day is a day in the U.S., in our country, where we stop and pay respect to those people who served our country. The thing about Veterans Day, though, is it draws a big distinction between Memorial Day, which is set aside in May for those people who may pay the ultimate sacrifice, who gave their lives for our country. And then there's also Armed Forces Day, which recognizes those people still serving.
What does Veterans Day mean to you?
You know, Veterans Day for me, it's a day that's increased in importance as I've gotten older and gotten farther removed from my military career. But to me, it's really a time to reconnect with a lot of the brothers and sisters that I served with. A lot of them are still, some of them are still even active duty to this day. But it's a time for me to kind of reflect on that shared experience. You can imagine that it's an experience that's very different. It's a bit more of a heightened reality than what we generally live day to day. And so the farther removed I get from it, and the more friends I lose contact with, the more I sort of look for some kind of connection to it again. And so Veterans Day is a great time for that. It's not just a time to get a free burger from Chili's, although they do that too. But yeah, it's just an opportunity for me to kind of reconnect with really good friends of mine. And we try to connect more through the year, but this is the day we all set aside for phone calls and shared memories. And then obviously some respects to our brothers and sisters who didn't come home.
What part of your identity has been shaped by your service?
It's interesting because so much of it, and you know, on a sort of surface personality wise, I'm pretty much the same guy that I was in high school. I like nerdy stuff. I'm into sports. I like movies, all those things. The kind of basis of me as a person really was reprogrammed in the best possible way. And I use the word reprogramming, right? And everybody thinks, oh, I told you the military were robots. And that isn't the case at all. I came out of basic training a much more confident version of myself, a much more disciplined version of myself. I joke that, you know, my teachers at St. Pius X High School would laugh if they knew I taught high school at a Catholic school. They would feel like it was ultimate proof that God has a sense of humor and that karma is real. I can see why, because I was kind of a hot mess that went from one idea to another with zero ability to stick with it. The military helped give me that. It helped focus the best parts of my personality, the best part of myself, into whatever goal I was working at the time. And I don't think I could have done anything like I did with my film career, with the film festival, or even creating this program if I didn't start with the basis of learning how to be focused and disciplined through the Army.
What is it like being a veteran in the U.S. today?
It's an interesting question, because here, it's a much different reality than it was as recently as, oh man, now 30 years ago. Now, when people find out you're a veteran, and it happens to me either at school or, you know, if I had a baseball game I'm covering, I do a hand salute during the anthem. And there's always someone who said thank you for your service. And I'll be honest, sometimes it's awkward for me to hear that. I don't know what to say. You're welcome for the freedom. I mean, I don't know how to really do that. But I think about how much better that is than when the guys who came home from Vietnam and what they were treated like. They were spat on. They were called baby killer. All of those things. And I just can't imagine surviving the most horrific experience of your life and then coming back to another almost equally, at least emotionally horrific experience. So, you know, for me now, there's a lot of stuff that I still have to deal with from the military. I'm pretty open about talking about PTSD stuff because we have to be talking about it. Otherwise, it's why we lose so many veterans every day, because it's hard to wrap their head around. But I think at the end of the day, I'm really thankful to be a veteran in this era than I would have been at any other.
Has being a veteran influenced how you teach?
Yeah, I think I rule my classroom with an iron fist, and I think that's what it comes from. No, I think, you know, it's interesting because I teach film, and I know that teaching film is easily dismissed as a class that's maybe unimportant. And, like, if you're trying to compare me to the biology teacher, absolutely, I get it. Ms. Thurman, I know you teach some science of sorts. I don't know. But you're obviously important. But I think what it's allowed me to do is realize that we have a young generation of kids that I want to, A, have some of the discipline that I had coming out of the military when it comes to chasing down this career. It's easy to have a film career, and it's you can make it happen, but it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude and discipline and the ability to not take no for an answer. And so I hope to impart that. But I also want them to realize, like, look, we are living in a society where we have a lot of comfort and a lot of, I know the word privilege is like a word that everybody kind of freaks out today, but it's true. Like, we have more privilege living in America than someone who was born somewhere else. And I want them to at least have appreciation that the reason why all these kids can decide frequently or freely that I'm going to go to school and study this or I'm going to do this with my life is because we have a whole generation of Americans who willingly paid the ultimate sacrifice for that right. And as long as I can impart a little bit of that, then it's worth it to me.
Do you have a special connection with other veterans?
I do. And it's what's interesting about some of that is on the surface, there's not a whole lot of us in common, really, because the military is like everywhere else. It's a really nice microcosm of the country. And so, you know, there are certain things that a lot of vets are into. I'm not a hunter, and that's a big thing they do. I don't know why I'd willingly be cold and wet, but that's a thing. But there is obviously a common ground. And it was funny because at St. Michael's, they had a military day at the football game. And you had clusters of vets, and somehow we had all found our branch. So I was hanging out with a bunch of Army dudes, and there were Navy guys and Air Force guys. So it was definitely something that kind of was special to share.
Who's on first? The Let's Get To Local 9, brought to you by Zoomer Sport.
So we are very excited to be joined on our Veterans Day episode by Dean McKissick, who is, among many things that he wears, many hats you wear, you also wear the helmet of military liaison. Dean, how's it going, man?
Oh, it's going great. Thank you for having me on, Jim.
Yeah, but now before we jump into that, tell me a little bit about you. How did you go from being a kid that I presumed liked baseball to now being part of the front office of a minor league baseball team?
Well, that's exactly right. I grew up baseball, played baseball in high school in town in Colorado Springs at Pine Creek High School. Went to college and graduated from UCCS, which is the sister school of Boulder here in Colorado Springs. And basically always knew I wanted to do something in sports. In college, I worked for UCCS's athletic department as part of a work study, was always been around sports, kind of also on the administrative side. From there, I scored an internship with USA Basketball, actually, which only really strengthened that drive to stay in sports. Once COVID hit, unfortunately, the internship program had to get wiped out there. And here we are, then started throwing my name in the hat for different jobs locally, helped out as a GA for the UCCS baseball team with Dave Hadjick, which is a absolute legend in the community as far as Colorado Springs baseball goes, who had a lot of ties with the Rocky Mountain Vibes, actually coached with the Sky Sox, which is what we were formerly known as before.
Right.
Had a brand change interned here as the group sales associate, just because intern in the sales world is sometimes a bad word, so we don't like to fling that word around as much. So I was an associate for the last 9 months or so throughout the 2021 season. Did well and enjoyed it a lot, and thankfully they brought me on full time.
You guys have had some change. First of all, you did change the brand a few years ago into what I think the best brands in all of baseball. I've got a lot of gear of it back home.
Yeah,
but sure. Also the move to independent ball. How was that? How did the fans react to that sort of change going from affiliated minor league to now a whole different kind of baseball in the Pioneer League?
I would say we personally as a baseball, I don't even want to say purist because, you know, you can border on extreme with that as well. But I was worried, of course, you know, how would the community react to it? And honestly, it was such a resounding relief to see people just want to see good baseball. and independent level baseball at our position as a MLB partnership. I mean, we are getting top of the top guys, guys that were late cuts from spring training, and they get picked up. And so the competition in the Pioneer League is really as good as it gets. I'd say it's probably equal or akin to low single A rookie ball. So we still felt like, okay, we got a really good product on the field. Now, how are our fans going to react? Because AAA to independent is, you know, in a course of 5, 6, 7 years, that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
And what we learned is people just want to watch good baseball. They want to bring families out and have something to do, especially after COVID. So seeing that, you know, some attendance records were broken and people coming out in full droves every single night really was made it all worth it and quieted a lot of those fears.
One of the things that minor league baseball is the best at is being reflective of the community. It's being part of that community. And, you know, this is our Veterans Day episode, and you guys have a big military community. Talk to me a little bit. First of all, sure. Just paint the picture for us. For those of us who don't know, how big is the military presence in Colorado Springs?
Oh, it's hard to put into words how important and big that community is. We have multiple bases from Fort Carson to Peterson, to obviously Air Force Academy. It's basically a lifeblood for our team, is making sure that we are doing everything we can to embrace the military community and make sure that they're coming out as well. And we do that in a litany of ways, whether that's joining up with certain nonprofits like Mount Carmel, who do just an incredible job, or 719 Heroes connected with Cell State and Cross Country Mortgage, who really go above and beyond reaching out and helping military veterans transition into housing, or just giving them the resources that they need. So partnering up with people like that in the community, that is absolutely priority A. Priority B is making sure that they know that they can come out to UC Health Park and that they're going to be taken care of. So in the past, it was Thursdays. We are in the process of changing it to Sundays, having military appreciation games every Sunday, which essentially means if you are military, former military, you just flash your military ID and you get in for free.
Nice.
We have which is my favorite game, especially since I am the military liaison here. So it's my baby, is the Army versus Air Force game, which is we invite Fort Carson, which is an Army base and Army post, and Air Force Academy in Peterson, and Space Force now, which is a whole nother entity now in the last few years. They come out, we split the stands up, we do Army versus Air Force, and it is one of our top games we have. It's one of our biggest games as far as attendance goes, and it really is cool. We get the salute battery out here, we line them up down third base line, and it is hard to comprehend how loud those things are. People are warning me, because it was my first go around, that like, you got to take a step back here, or your ears are going to be ringing for a couple of weeks now. And they were not kidding. Those things are legit. Also, you know, getting the Mounted Color Guard to come out and Fourth ID Band to do the national anthem. Really cool. Kind of like almost a military festival is the word I would describe it as. And then recently, just last Saturday, was our Colorado Springs Veterans Day Parade, which is an annual parade we do in town. Last year got nixed because of COVID, so there definitely was a lot of excitement to get out there and do it again. But a lot of people in the community bring out floats, bring out cars, and we walk down Tejon Street, which is a main street down in downtown Colorado Springs, and it is just awesome.
Do you hear from servicemen a lot? So I'm a vet, and I remember going to ballparks. Yeah, that you're very welcome. But I, you know, it was always important when I got to go to a ball game, because for a minute I felt like it was home. Do you hear that from any of the active duty guys? Like, hey, I'm not from here, but I'm glad I get to at least be at a ballpark every once in a while.
Absolutely. I think that's what makes minor league baseball and overall such a cool thing to give to a community, is that it's so widespread. So if you're living in, Tacoma, or if you're living in Fayetteville, or if you're living in Colorado Springs, there's going to be a minor league baseball team for you to go to and find that home, find that balance and almost piece of normalcy that we offer. And that's was critical for us coming out of COVID, was to remind the community that especially in our position where we used to be the Sky Sox. Changes happen every year. What are we, AAA now? What are we, rookie ball? So make sure reminding the community that we are here and we're a staple. And really was such a resounding relief and awesome to see just how remembered we were. Because we were the ones that were self-conscious about it, like coming out of COVID. Oh, boy.
Right.
What do we need to do to really spark energy back in the building and make sure the community knows that the Rocky Mountain Vibes are here to stay and are a great option for families to go to? And yes, the people coming in really was made it confirmed that what we're doing here matters and to keep on going. And then to piggyback off that, same thing with the parade was just going down that down Tejon Street and hearing everyone go toasty, go and all that. I was like, wow, man, what we're doing, you know, is leaving an impact and leaving an imprint on the community. And that is so cool to be a part of that.
What time of year is the Air Force Army game usually?
August 14th was last year. So okay. it's about in the last third of the season, I'd say.
Okay. Yeah. I'll definitely work to get out there. All right. So let's play a little rapid fire before we, let's get back to work. Hot dogs or brats?
Oh, brats.
Superman or Batman?
Batman.
Strangest thing you've ever seen at a ballpark?
Rapid fire, Dean. Come on. strangest thing I've ever seen at a ballpark. Boy, we got some torrential downpour this season and some of our drains were a little bit outdated maybe. And we had puddles of water around our warning track infield, you know, behind home plate, where all of us, grounds crew, front office staff, our GM, our president, we were down there just pumping water, putting it in a bucket. I'd say if you were a fan that day, you'd be like, this is pretty strange.
Okay. What is your favorite baseball uniform?
Oh, it's gotta be the Yankee pinstripes.
Okay. Godfather 1 or 2.
Hey, if there was no Godfather 1, there wouldn't be a Godfather 2. So I'm going to go Godfather 1.
I like it. All right. If you could own one team that is not your favorite team, which one would it be and why? Any sport.
If I could own a team, I think I would love to own. I would love to own the Washington Nationals because I think that is, as far as location goes, I mean, and I love their uniforms. I don't know why that would mean anything to me, but I think the Washington Nationals would be a cool team to own, especially being able to live in DC and rub shoulders with the guys down there would be pretty cool.
Okay. Star Wars or Jaws?
Star Wars.
Okay. What would you eat for your last meal on Earth?
My mom's sausage and rigatoni.
Okay. And then would you have that meal with Michael Scott from The Office or Leslie Knope from Parks and Rec?
Yes. Leslie Knope is amazing, but it's got to go Michael Scott.
You just like awkward dinners, I guess.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. More awkward, the better.
Okay. What was the first time baseball ever broke your heart?
Oof. Got to be 7th grade, 8th grade, travel ball tournament. You know, I think sometime in that period, it was every other week. I mean, my heart was getting broken or my heart, you know, I was having the greatest day of my life. Those were some good days playing baseball and travel of all times.
All right. And if not baseball, what other sport would you work in?
Basketball.
All right. Dean, thanks so much for jumping on Let's Get To. Like I said, we're going to be out to see the Rocky Mountain Vibes next year and we'll reach back out before we get out there.
Awesome. I am looking forward to it.
And now let's go into the eye of the storm with the Omaha Storm Chasers. And we're excited to be jumping back on with friend of the show as we wrap up the minor league baseball season, Marty Cordero, president of your Omaha Storm Chasers. Marty, first of all, just broad strokes, man. How good was it to be back and have just sort of what felt like almost normalcy by the time you guys ended your season?
Oh, it was great. And, you know, mid-June to mid-August, I think we've talked about that. It was as close to normal for us as it has been in the past. Mid-August to the end of September, we were extremely enthused about because our group sales team was just crushing it along the way, selling picnics and groups. on the larger side. And then once Delta started to grow, it kind of put a damper those last 5-6 weeks of the season. And, you know, companies didn't pull their business, but they did roll those groups and picnics and tickets into 2022. So we've got a hell of a start for next season in group sales, but it did kind of, it took a little bit of, wind out of our sails, if you will, at the end of the season that could have really been an amazing September. And, you know, you and I've spoken, I'm really excited about September minor league baseball. And I think going forward, I definitely remain bullish. This year was just kind of,
Yeah, I think that this year too, you had to add a lot of caveats, because even as the virus sort of ebbed and flowed, people's confidence also had to have that perfect storm of people feeling safe going out. And I know you guys did a great job, but bullish on September baseball. I love that, because I think, you know, it's definitely mixed across the sport, whether people think it'll be sustainable that late into it. So you're still looking forward to next year playing a little bit later than normal?
Absolutely. 100,000,000%. And you know, if there's anything that I learned this year, that's the one thing I did learn, is companies would definitely talk to us about bringing large groups and picnics out in September for September games. Whereas when we're talking April games, that means we're selling them and calling on clients in January, February. No one in Omaha is going to talk to you in January and February when there's 6 inches of snow and it's 20 degrees on the ground, maybe, about April baseball, but they absolutely will talk to you about September to bring their companies out. And that's a growth opportunity for us in Omaha, as well as others throughout the market, throughout the industry.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the future of the sport. And it's one of the things I love having you on about, because I think you are someone with vision. I think you can see things 3 years, 4 years, 5 years down the road. And it comes on the heels of the announcement of Marvel in minor league baseball partnering up. Is that what you see? Do you see Major League Baseball and through minor league baseball making large decisions like that, or partnerships like that? Or will you, as the Omaha Storm Chasers, also still be allowed to sort of make partnerships at the team level to kind of customize a fan appreciation experience?
If you're speaking specifically about, you know, large franchise decisions, you know, whether it's continuing to have Star Wars night, whether it's the new partnership with Marvel, the Copa de la Diversión program that continues to grow, I do think, Jim, that those are going to be less localized, less club controlled than past. And, you know, I don't like that at all. And, you know, I've long been a fan of what we do as community, what we do is not necessarily baseball. So it concerns me. It does. I think the Marvel partnership has a lot of opportunity, but there are a lot of parameters about what we can and can't do, and when we can and can't announce it, and when we are going to be able to get our merchandise from a standpoint of lead time versus where we fall in the pecking order with production. So, a lot of great things on the surface, absolutely. And we're one of the teams that bought in and signed on for the next 3-year program. But it remains to be seen how much local upside there truly will be. Because, you know, when we're able to take the names, for example, let's go back 25, 30 years in minor league baseball, most of the team names were still the Omaha Royals, or, you know, you get whatever, you know, pick whatever name you want to pick. And over a period of, you know, 20, 25 years, you went from 160 minor league clubs, which about 100 of them in the late 80s, early 90s were still named their big league affiliate. And then over the next 20, 25 years, the names localized. They became Omaha Storm Chasers. They became the Flying Squirrels in Richmond. And I could go on and on, but, you know, we don't have all day. You know, people can go do their own research. I see that's more representative of what minor league baseball is today and has been the last 15, 20, 25 years. I can't tell you that will continue to be what's representative on the business and the commercial side going forward. So I'm very eager to see what happens with Marvel. And again, I don't know that that's all a bad thing, but we will see how many good things come out of it, us not having that control.
I, you know, when when all of this happened, I tried to get on the bright side of things. And, you know, I thought about everybody that complained about when Disney bought Star Wars, and everybody thought there'd be less Star Wars and Star Wars would be bad. And I could argue that some of the Star Wars we've had from Disney has been some of the best Star Wars, right? We've Mandalorian, for example. But it doesn't seem logical to me. And maybe you can add some sort of, you know, light to this, but if you're going to invest in a minor league business that's working, and before the pandemic hit, it was working, it's because it was so localized. So why homogenize it? Why make it such a sort of same exact experience from ballpark to ballpark by having the exact same promotion and this thing and that thing? Why do that? How is that smart business?
Cat has my tongue. I don't know, Jim, because you're confirming what I just said. And we will see. I mean, if the business deals and the merchandise opportunities grow from a material perspective, I guess that's one answer. If you're just looking at, you know, top line revenues and then, you know, bottom line numbers as well. But I don't know. We will see. And, you know, I'm not involved in the custom and the creation of logos. I know that there are opportunities through the Marvel catalog for us to customize things club by club. So we'll see. We'll see what those merchandise sales are. I just hope there's enough flexibility. And, you know, I hope that we can wake up in 5 years and still have a potholes night. Or we can still have, you know, a what if night featuring Omahogs or Windwalkers or so on and so forth. And I think that we will. I do. But we really don't know until we go through it.
Do you guys have a voice in the room to help protect that sort of thing? I mean, is there advocacy for you guys to make sure that some of the local needs of the Omaha baseball fan are met?
There are committees that speak on behalf of all minor league clubs. I think the committees fundamentally and organically mean well, but there's only so much impact and influence that we can have when, you know, our partner is Major League Baseball. And, you know, Major League Baseball brings a lot of great assets. I mean, they do. They have a lot of great connections. You know, they've been doing commercial deals at a much larger level for years. And we need to at least trust to give them an opportunity over the next 3 to 5 years to show us, you know, how they can help improve our business.
Okay. So we keep talking about the changing landscape. And I think, you know, the pandemic really affected minor league baseball, especially when it hit with contraction. And now there's news that Silver Lake Partners is looking to start buying up minor league baseball teams. It looks like 17 have been identified. Overall, what are some of the, I guess, benefits, but really what are some of the concerns when we have sort of one company now owning large chunks of the minor league baseball landscape?
Well, you know, some of the benefits, I believe, you know, if you're one of those 17 markets and maybe you've been undercapitalized, or maybe, you know, you're in a market that has a lot of upside, but the city government or state, county, whoever your landlord is, hasn't put the right investment into the facility, and a cash infusion can help put a new picnic area in, put a new scoreboard in, whatever it might be that's separate from the required new major league facility requirements. I think that is a benefit. You know, having a company with that type of money obviously gives a more stable foundation. Concern on the other end, are they going to implement leadership management from outside of XYZ or said city? Because again, we keep talking about community. We're nothing more than community businesses. And, you know, the local president, the local GM, the local AGMs, the local staff, you know, being on different volunteer boards, charity boards, nonprofit organization, being in the community, just fundamental to what minor league baseball is. So I hope that it is a business play that doesn't change the day-to-day on how minor league clubs have operated successfully for a number of years. But, you know, I don't know the 17 markets. I've read like everyone else has.
Right.
But we'll see. You know, from a competition, I've been asked from a competition perspective, and what if you own two clubs in the same market? Much different than owning two independent soccer clubs or two independent baseball clubs. I mean, look at what just happened with Lexington and West Virginia. You know, Andy Shea and you know, he and his mother own both of those clubs, and they played for the Atlantic League Championship, playing each other, yeah. And they do control the play on the field. Two affiliated minor league clubs, let's say that they owned Omaha and Durham, for example, and we played, well, the Rays and the Royals are controlling the players, sure. So you're not going to have any influence. So I don't know that there's really any issue with the old rule that you couldn't own two affiliated clubs in the same league. I don't think that's an issue anymore. So, you know, I think there's concern, but I also think there's opportunity.
I'll remain positive and say, you know, they want to go into business in these regions for a reason. They see an opportunity, and I don't think you can be successful at the minor league level without reflecting the community you're in. So hopefully they'll bring that sort of to fruition. Now let's talk a little bit about just the Storm Chasers, part of the Royals system, another good season for you guys. How important is it, or how beneficial is it to you as someone who has to promote a team for that team and that system to be good? I mean, outside of, you know, the Rays system, which was unreal this year, by the way, it's not much better than what the Royals are putting out there in the minor leagues.
Yeah, you know, Quad Cities was one of the top three to four teams from a win percentage perspective. They won High A Central. Double A Central was won by Northwest Arkansas. We, through the end of maybe it was middle of June, we had the best record in all of minor. Maybe it's the end of June. At the Triple A level, we had the best record, but we had the best record in all of minor league baseball. And then obviously the Royals had some pitching woes, and then that started the I-29 shuffle, if you will. but our team still did lead all of minor league baseball home runs. We set a club record for home runs in, I don't know, 15 fewer regular season games. And for the 10 game home run chase at the end, we won another $6,200 for world champion boxer Bud Crawford's B&B Sports Academy here in North Omaha, because we were hitting like 2.5-3 home runs a game. It was just something, it was ridiculous. So a lot of talent, a lot of excitement. We can't wait for the next 3 to 4 years. I don't know if it's going to replicate 2010 through 2014, when we just continued to win and win and win, and we adopted the hashtag all we do is win. That'd be great to start using that again next year, but we'll see what happens. But I think it matters in a new age minor league baseball, having a little bit more focus on the baseball because of the social media and the digital media channels and might that BAM has through Major League Baseball. They control that now. That was one upside. Our highlights were readily available, much more available this year than they have been in past. So we need to continue to do more of promoting baseball than we have in the past.
Well, let's talk a little bit about winning. Let's talk a little Union Omaha. For a production note, we are shooting this before the playoffs start, but just how cool is it to kind of be also on that side of minor league independent sports and seeing that level of success?
It doesn't suck. you know, it's been a definite learning experience. Clubhouse champagne.
Oh, love it.
It's been a definite learning experience. On the business side, from a fan demo perspective, to get very granular. The sports side, I'm learning more as it comes. You know, I don't understand clean tackles versus dirty tackles. I mean, to me, they're either all dirty or all clean, but they're not, and I'm learning that. I understand.
Are you basically the Ted Lasso of GMs? And
I'm probably at least from what I've watched, I probably have more soccer knowledge than Ted does.
But, you might yeah. Actually. Yeah.
I don't know though. His worldviews are much needed this day and age. So I'll give him that. No, but you know, it's been exciting, and to have the club have the success, finish second in the league last year, qualify for the final. Obviously, COVID took the final from us. Pretty much wire to wire first place. We fell out in second place a little bit in late August, early September this year. But for the most part, Jay Mims has had this club wire to wire. And, you know, I'm excited for this this coming Saturday, the 6th. And I know we're filming in advance of that, and this will air a little bit after that. So I hope that we went on the 6th here at home, and then we'll host the championship on the 13th. And hopefully the next time we record, we'll be talking about, you know, how exciting it was again. But great clubhouse celebration on Saturday night. Always wonderful to win at home in front of the home fans. And for me, having done a number of clubhouse celebrations, it was really cool to see staff and players that had never been able to participate that way. Because a lot of these guys had won championships and celebrated at university level, at college level, but many of them had never done professional level with champagne and beer and loud music and nice, fun speeches and all those things. So it was quite the experience in the Union Omaha locker room this past Saturday, a couple Saturdays ago.
Well, I we will definitely update before we drop the episode on how it went. So as we wrap up, speaking of winners and things, you know, we do our own awards here at Let's Get Two, and I like to surprise people by letting you know that you will be sharing one part of our Ben Hill Minor League Baseball Person of the Year Award, Marty. Oh. I can't really just put into words people listen to you in the sport. They follow you. You are, and I think you have the best intentions for the sport. And I love the fact that you're so open and honest about all that. So congratulations. We'll get all those announced and in the mail to you soon.
Jim, that's awesome. I'm not sure exactly what the award is, but anything that has Ben Hill's name on it probably is a little tongue in cheek. So
it's our biggest award of the year. It'll be a nice plaque with your name on it. We're still, you know, working on fun stuff.
But. That's awesome. You know, Ben's meant so much to our industry, as it relates to visiting every minor league ballpark and talking about promotions of the week. Yes, a lot of his stuff is tongue in cheek, but he has been a voice for us as an industry, whereas not very many others were from a promotions perspective. And he has long highlighted the positives. In the last 3 years, there were a lot of tough years, whether it be the MLB process, whether it be COVID, whether it be a number of clubs, markets being contracted, whether it be a number of clubs relocating. Ben's always been that voice. So I'm humbled. That's awesome. I'm humbled.
Well deserved. We will talk to you very soon, my friend.
Bye, Jim.
Holler and a swaller, a chug of ballpark brew, presented by The Hitter Sports.
So this is Holler and a Swaller, brought to you by The Hitter Sports. Make sure you follow The Hitter Sports on Twitter. I'm sure he's going to be a lot of fun as we get into crazy hot stove season and the Yankees start signing either the right free agent or the wrong one. Never can tell. But we are going to be drinking the Old Humble Distilling Company Special Reserve Whiskey. Now, before we dive into it, we are very excited because we have the folks behind the whiskey on the show right now. So as we said at the beginning of this segment for Holler and a Swaller, we are bringing on Joe Breida from Old Humble Distilling Company. Joe, first of all, I know you're a big Astros fan. We are recording this 1 week later. How are you doing?
You know, it was a great season. It was a fantastic season, and it was fun to watch. And, you know, the 29th best team, or I guess the second best team, better than 29 other teams in the league. That's not bad. Not bad at all.
No, I don't think next year.
And
I think next year is going to be good. And I don't think you can get too much into this all or nothing thing.
There were people saying that Dusty Baker should be fired if he doesn't win the World Series because he's not a successful coach. I'm like, come on. One coach wins the World Series. This guy's been in the World Series 2 years in a row, and you're going to say he's not successful because he didn't. Whatever. And how many years was Bobby Cox in the National League Championship Series before the Braves finally broke through the one time they broke through.
And he's got a statue out there.
So I know, right?
There you go. Real quick, do you think Correa comes back?
If he wants to,
yeah,
he will. If he wants a 10-year deal, I go back and forth on this in my head. Like, it would be great to see him come back. It would be great to see him retire in an Astros uniform, pay the man his money, give him his 10-year deal. But then the other part of me says, are you going to pay his replacement $30 million a year for the last 4 years of Correa's contract?
Yeah.
Because he's done. Ah.
Yeah.
That's hard math. You know, there's a reason these guys run their teams the way they run their teams. They're not sentimental about their players. We got great years out of Carlos Correa. If we don't get the next 6 years out of him, somebody else will pay $30 million for the last 4 years of his contract.
And you actually put that the best that I've ever heard it of. Yeah, you're going to – I mean, we saw Bagwell at the last couple of years of his career. You're paying for those years.
He couldn't throw the ball back to the mound.
Yeah.
They had to, like, pull him out of cold storage in 2005 to play against the White Sox in the World Series in his last-ditch effort to be in a World Series. It was tough. I love Bagwell, but it was tough to watch. Those last couple of years was just tough to watch.
Absolutely. Now, what's not tough to watch or tough to drink is this is amazing.
Thank you, sir.
In my review, which will play after this interview, so dangerously smooth. You can just like sit back, but talk to me a little bit about how you even just got into this game in the first place. What brought you to it to join this very growing Texas community of distilleries?
Well, honest to goodness, back when I was 19 in college at the University of Houston, go Cougs, I was a home brewer with my high school buddy. He went to Nacogdoches at Stephen F. Austin. I was at the University of Houston. We both decided to start making beer kind of at the same time. And I was a home brewer. I was one of the most popular kids in the dorm, making beer in my dormitory because it was completely illegal to buy beer, but right around that time it was legal. The laws in Texas had been changed to make homebrewing legal and easier to do. So I'm pretty sure it was still against the law for me to actually possess it and drink it. But at the very least, I could get around the whole buying beer thing. Always remember, kids, drink responsibly. Like, make sure you have a friend, don't overdo it, et cetera, et cetera. But after college, from beer making, we went, I started to do winemaking went from winemaking to wine tastings because I could actually explore a wider variety of the wines that were available doing wine tastings. And it was just a freak event, kind of a connection of two people at the right time, right place. Somebody invited me to a whiskey tasting. I'd never been to a whiskey tasting before. I wasn't a particular fan of whiskey at the time. My impression of whiskeys were that they all kind of tasted the same and I didn't really like them. Partly because I would buy a bottle 1 month and then 2 or 3 months later buy another bottle and it was the same style of a Kentucky style bourbon from the same 60 mile radius. And it really did kind of taste mostly the same. They use the same barrels, they use the same water, they use the same area, use the same grains. It was, in some cases, it was the same still. But I go to this tasting and it was a whiskey tasting that was focusing on Scotch, and it was Scotches from several different regions and they were all side by side by side. And I, for the first time, realized the difference that you could get in whiskey using the same grain, but using different climates, because each one of these whiskeys was a very specific different climate from Scotland. And then the next tasting I went to was a whiskey tasting from the United States. It was a bourbon tasting and we tasted the different styles of bourbon, the different areas that it came from. The different expressions of the same spirit. And that's when I fell in love with the idea of bourbon and whiskey and the actual spirit, the different flavors. And I explored all over the different brands and the different styles and right about that same time, the laws in Texas were changing to allow micro distilleries and micro breweries to sell on site. And that is right about the same time I was getting my MBA and looking for businesses to either start or buy into. And I started a business plan for a distillery and was off to the races at that point. That was 2012 when I started the business plan. In 2013, we had the stills and location and license. In 2014 was our first batch of bourbon, and we opened our doors to the public for the first time.
Go back to that 2014 then. What was it like to get to taste your first batch, like after 2 years of working on it?
Man, it is a making whiskey is one part creation and one part discovery. What I learned from making beer was how the grains go together and what the grains are going to express themselves as when you boil them and put them into the wash and you ferment them and do all the things to them. That's the creation part of the story. The discovery part of the story is when you take the whiskey and you put it in barrels, and now you have to wait 6 months. If it's the 5 gallon barrels that we use, 6 to 9 months. So we had to, I had a pretty good idea that what it would taste like coming out of the barrel because we drank it off the still, obviously. But when you finally, for the first time, take that spirit and you bring it down to 90 proof, for our case, it's 90 proof. When you bring it down to bottle proof and you drink it for the first time, this is it's the culmination of in this case, it was a 2 year process of experimentation and fiddling around and figuring out what we were going to do. You're stepping onto undiscovered territory for the first time. Nobody else has had this drink, and it is an amazing experience. It's a fulfilling experience, and it's a tremendous amount of fun. And you're interviewing me today, and in 2 days this whiskey goes into its new bottle with its new labels, and that's all I can say about that.
is it a new batch, a new kind? It's
a brand new whiskey, and when we're recording this, the date of this recording, the official announcement of the label and the whiskey and the release is going to be 2 days from now.
All right.
And I have this entire schedule of stuff planned out. I don't even have the labels in the distillery right now, so I was going to offer to show you the labels, but I don't have the labels.
We'll make sure that we share it when it hits social. We'll make sure that we get it up and out for you.
But it's the same thing. Like, this is the culmination. This is the first new release of a whiskey that we've had since 2019, and it's super exciting. We've redone our labels. We've redone our process. We've moved facilities, changed the water we use from municipal water to captured rainwater. So like in the last 2 years, all of our whiskeys have improved significantly in flavor, but this is the first new release in 2 years. And yesterday I bottled up 12 bottles, and I actually pulled the first shot off of the first new bottle that came off of the bottling line. And it was like just divine. It was this complete culmination of effort over the last year and a half of just developing that flavor.
And I love the idea of using captured rainwater too. That's got to be something relatively unique in this industry.
Yeah, I think so. Garrison Brothers does it, and I'm sure there's another distillery or two that does it. We're doing it pretty much out of necessity. There is no, where this facility is, there's no municipal water. There's no utility district over here. We're outside of city limits, and we're not in a developed area. So we have to either use well water or rainwater, and the well water in this area, to a large extent, has kind of been spoiled by the oil industry in the area. It's not bad. It just has heavy compounds in it. Sure. So you can drink it, but you'll taste it when you do. Okay, and that makes for less than ideal whiskey.
Because the water is key, right? Like that's the most,
Yeah, there a ridiculous amount of water goes into making whiskey. Like 30 gallons of bourbon. If we distill 30 gallons of bourbon, we've used 300 gallons of water to start with. And then we add in another 10 or 15 gallons of additional water. So the every bottle in our case is 55% water. but it starts off as 90% water.
Yeah.
And you distill the alcohol out of that 90% water.
So talk to me a little bit as we kind of wrap up. What makes your whiskey stand out? What makes it special? Why do people need to rush to their local specs like I did to grab a bottle and you know, toast their veteran friends or get ready for Thanksgiving or whatever?
Well, what I would say is the philosophy behind the whiskey that we make is that whiskey should be easy to drink. It's a recreational drug. You shouldn't be fighting your way to the bottom of a bottle. You shouldn't fight your way to the bottom of a glass.
Yeah.
With the idea of an easy drinking whiskey is core to our entire production philosophy. If you have the shot in front of you and you have to psych yourself up to drink it and then pound it back and then drown it with something else so you get the taste out of your mouth, you need a better whiskey. And I've got a few to recommend. They're the ones with the oil there, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us. And so now we are going to have a little sample. ASMR. So I want to send this out to everybody that I've served with. Most importantly, Eric Adair, who has become one of the most important people in my life, but everybody that put a uniform on with me, even if it was a different uniform, like one of my very favorite people, Matt Dudley, thank you so much for answering the call, for having my back, if that was needed at the moment. But again, this country is special because of people who willingly take up its defense. So happy Veterans Day, holler and a swaller. This is dangerously smooth. Make sure you check out some of this great local Texas whiskey, Old Humble Distilling Company. I got mine at Specs. You can get yours probably anywhere they sell liquor, but definitely Specs.
And now on to close it out, the right-hander from Houston, Texas, James Christopher.
So it does wrap up this episode of Let's Get To. Thanks so much for everybody for joining on. And in case you've been hiding under a rock, most of America got its wish when my beloved Houston Astros lost in the World Series. And I had a bunch of students come up to me and they asked me, like, is this the saddest you've ever been about a sport? And I'm a ranker. Those of you who follow any of our shows know that I like to rank everything. And I was really doing some real soul searching and some introspection. And that's where I came up with my 10 most disappointing sports moments of my life. And I'm going to begin with number 10, which was the 2006 NFC wildcard game, the famous Tony Romo fumble, the game that made me hate Tony Romo for the rest of his career. I will barely listen to him on TV. He had a chance to become the next iteration of great clutch Cowboys quarterbacks. And instead he became a joke. And the sad thing is there's an entire generation of Cowboys fans who thinks he's the best quarterback that ever played for him. So that is my number 10. Number nine was the 2004 NLCS, losing that game to the Cardinals. And I remember just being crushed because of, you know, the comeback and Jeff Kent's home run and feeling like, it felt like the last chance for that particular Astros team to get to a World Series. So 2004, the way that series, that season ended, it was a real bummer. Despite the fact that it was the farthest they progressed through the playoffs to their history, because if you remember in the 80s and such, there were no DS rounds. It was straight into the LCS round. So that was definitely a big bummer of a moment for me. Number eight was the 1994 NFC Championship game. And this featured the Cowboys going down real early to the 49ers and then fighting back. And, you know, it shouldn't have stung that much because it was coming off of two straight Super Bowl wins. But with the way that the offseason had transpired for the Cowboys, with the famous and just colossal mistake of Jimmy Johnson either being fired or quitting or both. It really made just that loss seem that much more bitter at that moment. And, you know, didn't really know if that was truly the end of an era for the Cowboys. Number seven, the 1998 National League Division Series, Houston Astros against the San Diego Padres. And it was, I think it was the best Astros team to date and would be the best Astros team until this run of 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. And it featured Randy Johnson, who was just lights out, but they ran into the San Diego Padres at just the right time. And to add insult to injury, I stumbled into Petco Park in 2018, just in time for them to be celebrating the 20th anniversary of that team, and just loved all those Astros highlights on the Petco Park video board. Number six, the 2005 World Series. Look, this should probably be higher because the team got swept, but I'll be honest, I was still really recovering from losing the 04 NLCS, and I was just excited to be in the World Series that it felt over before I knew it. I don't have a whole lot of specific memories for watching that particular series, and it's weird because, again, it was the World Series. It was my favorite team, but I think I was just excited to finally have a pennant that I blinked and I missed it. Number five brings us to the 2021 World Series. And yeah, it was a gut punch. I think the only thing that makes it easier to swallow was it's a pretty likable Braves team, but outside of Jock Peterson, who's just obnoxious. But yeah, definitely a gut punch. And sitting here at the end of it and really just being more than a week removed from it, the fear setting in of will they be back and what will it look like if they are? So it's definitely a very similar situation as to some of those earlier Astros losses. You'll notice that most of these, by the way, are in fact baseball driven. Number four, the 2008 Texas versus Texas Tech game. Texas comes out sluggish. It's night game in Lubbock. Those are always weird, but they fight back. They get back into it. And then a series of events transpires. Tech throws an interception. Blake Gideon gets it right here. Game over. Texas wins. The comeback's complete, except it isn't what happened. And Gideon drops the ball. And I have to remember, I very specifically remember this, having to calm Jessica down to tell her that the interception happened, that Texas hadn't won yet. And then the very next play is the Crabtree play. And that game ended up being huge because of the way the BCS worked and the way the Big 12 worked, which was all a little backwards. So they had a three-way tie with OU, with Texas, and with Tech, all at the same record. OU goes to the national championship game and gets shut out by Florida, and Texas doesn't get to go. And then it would have ended up being two national championship appearances in a row. Number three, the 1986 NLCS, maybe the series that most defines an entire generation of Astros fans. I'm 10 years old. For the first time ever, this team is really, really good, and I'm cognizant of it, you know, because I was only tangentially aware of the 1980 seasons and such. And then the series to be as dramatic as it was, many people say it's one of the five best MLB playoff series ever. So number three with a bullet. Number two and number one, I've changed positions on over and over and over. And as I record this, I'm flipping them. Formerly number one, currently number two, the 2009 national championship game, Texas versus Alabama. Now go back to that game, and Texas is running and throwing all over Alabama. They're getting ready to go up, I think, 17, and Colt McCoy gets a freak injury. Texas has to play Garrett Gilbert, who's very talented, but didn't get a lot of playing time in the regular season. He's awful in the first half, including an intercepted shovel pass, which I'm not sure you'll ever see again. Alabama runs ahead, survives the comeback, and Alabama becomes Alabama, and Texas becomes Texas. Imagine what happens if the scores are reversed. Mac Brown doesn't get gun-shy over how to run an offense, and we could be looking at two very different realities. The saddest part of it all, though, is the story of Colt McCoy in the locker room, and telling everybody he was good to go, and his dad throwing him a football and say, throw it to me, and he couldn't do it, bursting in tears. Cole McCoy is one of my favorite Longhorns ever, and would have loved to have seen him get to win a national championship. So 2 years in a row, he was sort of cheated out of that situation. But number one, 2019 World Series, the Astros are, I think, 8 outs away. There's a home run off the foul pole, and it just was downhill from there. And what had this number two for a while was that retroactively, I know it wasn't the end of anything. The Astros would go on to make two more ALCSs, one more World Series. And so the window remains open versus Texas just becoming, you know, the darkest times of that timeline. But those are my 10. And, you know, I probably have as many vivid memories of those losses as I do just about any of the wins. So that does wrap up this episode of Let's Get To. Thanks so much for everybody for joining. Next week, we're going to be back with our Thankful for Baseball episode, in which I will fix Major League Baseball. You're going to want to hear this because I think I've got some genius ideas that Rob Manfred really needs to pay attention to. But that does wrap us up. Thanksgiving's right around the corner. I love this time of year because just like in baseball, it applies to holidays as well. Always, whenever possible, let's get to it.